Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Okay, so we had Kavi Karnapur's own definition of poetry. Kavivan Nirmitihi Kavyam. Poetry is the verbal composition of a kavi. But then he gave a technical meaning to the word nirmiti. It's not just any construction out of words. Because then everything a poet says, including the most ordinary things he says, would also be poetry. But nirmiti means, what is it? Asadharana chamatkarini rachana. It's a composition, a creation, a construction that creates unusual sense of wonder. If the poet says, excuse me, you're stepping on my toe, that's not poetry. Unless something in what he's saying that creates great wonder in me. Okay. Now, Kavi Karnapur then looks at some other definitions and shows why he made a new definition and wasn't satisfied with his predecessors. First of all, his immediate predecessor, Mamata, the author of the Kavya Prakash, on which he bases a lot of the things he does say in this book. He agrees with Mamata on a lot of things, but he decided to give a somewhat different definition of poetry. Mamata's definition is tadadoshao shabdartao saguna analankritao punak kwapi. So poetry is a combination of words and meanings that are faultless, adoshao, and have good qualities, and sometimes have ornaments. Well, okay. What Kavi Karnapur finds wrong in that definition is that it's broad. There's ativyapti. It covers too many cases. It allows something to be considered poetry that really isn't poetry. Like if there was just the phrase out of context, just Kuranga Nayana, it's a metaphor. It's a rupaka, someone who has the eyes of a deer. Well, unless there was some transplant operation, the lady doesn't have literally the eyes of a deer. But we're saying it metaphorically. That's nice, but it's not poetry. It's an ornament, fine. It's a figure of speech, but so what? Out of context, just that those words don't evoke any great sense of wonder, or it doesn't awaken rasa in me. We don't know which lady we're talking about. And in whose idea she has eyes like a deer. It's not poetry just by itself. So therefore, Mamata's definition is too broad. It's words and their meaning. It doesn't have fault. It's got something good about it. It's got a nice alankar, a nice there's a nice metaphor involved. But it's not really poetry. It doesn't awaken this astonishment. Now, there's another definition in the Sahitya Darpana, given by Vishwanath Kaviraj. Vakyam rasatmakam kavyam. Sounds good. Poetry is speech, or poetry is, vakya. Vakya is a statement, which comprises rasa. Well, Yeah, but then we, you know, just the words, gopi, beer, sahaviharati, harihi, that would have to be considered a poem. There's rasa there. Krishna is playing with the gopis. That's Madhurya rasa. But I'm just saying the words. It doesn't awaken any special feeling in anybody. You got to be a poet to make poetry. You can't just talk about rasa without realizing it and without knowing how to evoke it. It's not poetry. Rasa is there, but it doesn't really awaken anybody's rasa. It's a rasika statement, but it's not poetry. So that definition doesn't work, that any words that are rasatmika. And also, the word vakya doesn't mean just words. It means a particular coherent construction of words. In other words, a statement or a sentence. A vakya is a statement, not just throw words in a bag and shake them up. There has to be coherence. What is the definition of vakya? Have you seen it? Where would you have you seen it? Okay. So where else have we seen it? Anyway, what is the definition of vakya? It has those three qualities. It's a collection of words, but it has to have akanksha, yogyata, and sanidhyam. Asati, say sanidhyam. Akanksha means the words are expecting one another. Just like you have a verb that wants an object, a transitive verb, a sakarmika verb. So there has to be that syntactic connection between the words. You have a subject, you want a verb. You have a verb, if it's a certain kind of verb, you want an object. Like that. You have a possessive, there should be some word that it's modifying, some other noun, if you have a shashti. Like that, words are expecting other words to complete the idea. That's called akanksha. If I just say horse, bull, elephant, that's a collection of words, but the words don't expect anything of each other. You know, just which is the subject? Is there a subject there? Is there an activity? You know, nothing's going on. So, and the second qualification is yogyata, suitability. This is not grammatical. This is semantic. This is a question of the meaning. Do the meanings fit one another? If I say he sprinkles with fire. Agni na sinchati. You don't do that. He sprinkled with water, and not with fire. So grammatically it's okay. It's the instrumental case. It's the karanam. But it's not appropriate. The meanings don't fit to talk about sprinkling with fire. That's lack of yogyata. A sentence has to have yogyata. The meaning has to be, the meanings of all the words have to fit together coherently. And sanidhyam. They should be close enough together. Not that I say one word today and another word tomorrow and expect it to make a sentence. You got to say it all at the same time. Okay. Well, look at the following words. Kurma loma pratachana shasha shringa danur daraha esha bandya vandya suto bhati kapushka kritashekaraha. You know what that means? Here is shining forth this son of a barren woman wearing the skin, not skin, but the hair of a tortoise. Okay, he's covered by a cloth that's made out of the hair of a tortoise. And his bow is made out of the horn of a rabbit. And he's got an ornament in his hair is a flower that grows in the sky. None of these things exist. So it's not according to the strict definition, it's not a vakya. It's not a sentence. Because there can't be expectancy between the words that don't refer to anything. The yogita is certainly not there. You know, the words, the word that doesn't refer to anything is not useful as any part of speech. So that's not a... Kavi Karnapur is arguing here, this is not a sentence, but it is poetry. It can, you know, it awakens some emotion in a certain context, maybe. But he says it is poetry, but in spite of the fact that it's not a proper sentence. So therefore he doesn't like that definition. Because poetry doesn't even have to be a real sentence. At least it can be a, you know, a pseudo sentence. Yes. The definition, yes, the third definition. Yeah, this is the third one offered. The second one, well, the first one is his own, and all the other ones he's defeating. All the subsequent ones are other people's definitions, and he gave his own definition because he doesn't like it, the previous definitions. So now he's giving an example of other people's definitions that he's not satisfied with. This is the definition of I'll get to you in a second. The definition of Sahitya Darpana, that Vakyam Rasatmakam Kavyam. That's the one he's dealing with here. Problem is, you can have poetry that's not a Vakya.
Vakyam Rasatmakam
I skipped that sentence.
So Vakyam Rasatmakam Kavyam is a definition of Sahitya Darpana, but Yad Vakyam Na Bhavati Tat Kavyam Na Bhavati. Is it the definition of
No, it's not a definition. This is Kavi Karnapur arguing that there's a counterexample. There's poetry that's not a Vakya. That's all he's saying. Because the definition would imply that what's a Vakya can't be poetry. But here's an example of something that's not a Vakya, but it is poetry. Okay, that's all. I don't know what the Yoga Vasishtha has to say about that. There's a verse reference here, but it's somebody's commentary. This is coming out of someone's commentary on the Yoga Vasishtha Ramayana. Nityanipu.
His counterexample. And that Yadvakyam.
There's a fault because of counterexample.
Yeah, and Yadvakyam na bhavati tata kavyam na bhavati.
Well, that's the implication. That's the logic of the definition.
Yeah, means this is actually what he argues against this.
Yeah, well, that's what yeah. Vishwanath's definition implies. What's not a vakya is not poetry.
Yeah.
According to the definition. Yeah. But here's a non-vakya that is poetry.
And what about the Krishna playing with the gopis? What was there?
The problem with that is that it's rasatmaka.
Mm-hmm.
It expresses a rasa, but it doesn't excite you. It doesn't create any chamatkar.
Yeah.
It's just a, you know, an ordinary person describing that Krishna's playing with the gopis. Well, just by talking about Krishna and the gopis doesn't make you a poet.
Yeah.
You got to have some genius to be able to actually awaken people's sense of wonder. Just saying the words doesn't evoke rasa. You got to actually have it. You got to experience it yourself, and you have to have the skill to awaken it in others.
I just remembered Mahaprabhu's statement when Rupa Goswami's poetic skills were appreciated by Ramananda Roy in the beginning of Antya Lila. Mahaprabhu says, what's the use of a poetry which enters the heart but doesn't spin the head? So,
yes.
So enters the heart but doesn't spin the head.
Yes, yes. That's real poetry. Okay. Now, another definition that he doesn't like. From Vamana, who wrote the Kavya Alankar, another textbook, old one. Ritir Atma Kavyasya. This is the Riti theory. The soul of poetry is style. Well, that's not a good definition, because style is just a superficial external quality. Um, But that was seriously presented as a theory of poetry, that it's all about style. Logotara, okay, another definition. This is actually a second definition given in the Kavya Prakash. Logotara chamatkara varnana nipuna kavis. Tasya vachak kavyam. Okay, now, a poet, first of all, a poet is someone who's expert in describing things in such a way as to evoke superworldly astonishment. Because there's ordinary astonishment. If you don't get off my toe, I'm going to punch you in the face. So a person may be shocked by hearing that, but that's not lokotara chamatkara. That's not superworldly astonishment. So a person who's expert in describing things in such a way as to create superworldly astonishment, he's a poet. And his words are poetry. This is Vamana's definition. Yes?
I'm just wondering if mundane poets, they're writing about worldly things, some silly love affair or something, then how is their thing poetry if it's not lokotara chamatkara?
Well, they're thinking that, the world of aesthetic experience, of artistic experience, is above the ordinary world. They don't know any real spiritual world, so they make up a make-believe spiritual world, the world of art. It's not just ordinary sex life, it's romance. Artistic romance. It's artificial. Yes.
It's like fantasy.
Yes.
So according to Kavi Karnapura, his own definition, none of the mundane poetries actually come under the category of poetry, isn't it true?
Yes, because
only the spiritual,
only that which can actually evoke true rasa, and an author who has no ability to experience rasa cannot write real poetry, according to Kavi Karnapura's opinion. Yes,
and whenever
the mundane poetry in the world is just garbage.
And whenever he refers to the word rasa, it means transcendental rasa between Radha and Krishna. That's all, isn't it? Krishna and his devotees. It doesn't refer to the mundane.
We cannot equate the two. If we do, then we're making serious philosophical mistake. Just in the name of poetry, to allow mundane rasa to creep in ruins everything. We can learn from mundane poets the skill of poetry. And here we're doing it. Kavi Karnapura is borrowing so many ideas, especially from Mamata, who is a mundane poet. Sometimes had a poem about Krishna and his devotees, but a lot of times had poems about, was presenting examples about mundane people. So we can use the ideas of the mundane theoreticians on poetry. Or we can even, if we want to bother, we can study mundane poetry to learn the skill. But it's not real poetry. It's just pseudo. It's a superficial, imitation of poetry. Still, we can even those who we paramatam atpatishidham anumatam, even the opponent's idea. If it's not specifically contradicted, we can accept for practical purposes. So we can study the theory given by mundane poets. We can even look at their examples. But real poetry exists only written by devotee authors, Vaishnava authors. Rasikas. The poet has to be rasika. He has to know what rasa is, be able to experience it and express it. We're just trying to learn how to become an audience. I don't think we're ready to start writing transcendental poetry. We can practice writing poetry and express whatever realization we have. But it becomes real poetry when you have rasa to express. Yeah. I'm sorry. Look onto that. Well, thing is, you can say transcendental above the world, but this is a mundane poet giving us his definition. This is Vamana speaking, who's not a devotee. So he just means, you know, above the ordinary world. You know, this is the elevated world of poetic expression, of art and poetry, that world. You know, above the ordinary world, where people just talk prose, is the world of poetry. But he doesn't have a proper spiritual idea, just some artificial idea of a higher realm of talking, above the ordinary world.
What's his
okay,
fault?
Now what? Now let's get back on track.
Yeah, what's his fault?
Well, that's what I'm going to tell you, if we can get back on track. The fault that Kavi Karnapur sees in this is circular reasoning. You're defining poetry in terms of a poet, but you're really defining a poet in terms of someone who writes poetry. Let's see how he. Okay, let me look at Vishwanath to explain that. Sorry, I'm in the wrong place. I have to find the right place here. In anyway, it's a poet is a poetry is what's written by a poet. But what does he say a poet is? Is someone who's expert in describing things that, in such a way as to create exceptional astonishment. But that is, you know, that's just defining a poet in terms of poetry. And then you're defining poetry in terms of a poet. You're going around in a circle. Let me find Vishwanath's actual statement of this. It's a little clearer. I got it. What do you see? Yes. Yes. Well, okay, it's just saying that the definition of poetry is in terms of a poet. But what how he explains what a poet is really in terms of poetry. It's going around in a circle. Okay. Now, some ways to complain. Well, your definition, Kavi van Nirmati Kavyam, doesn't that have the same circular problem? That you're saying poetry is what a poet, the verbal composition by a poet. And he defends himself saying, no, we don't have that fault of going around in a circle, defining each part in terms of the other part, because the word kavi is paribhashika, samgya. That means that it's a technical term that's fundamental to our philosophy. We start off understanding what a poet is, and then in terms of a poet, we can define what poetry is. But we're not defining poet in terms of poetry. We haven't given the definition of a poet yet. Let's look at the definition of a poet and see whether it's... See, if we just say that somebody who can describe things, you know, can use his words in such a way as to evoke a sense of astonishment, that's a poet. That's just saying that a poet is someone who writes poetry. Let's see if Kavi Karnapur can come up with a better definition of poet that doesn't depend on the idea of poetry. Then we're not going around in a circle. Then he's justified. And he's just about to do that. Next topic is what is a poet? Okay? The karaka number 9. There's a little bit left of this karaka, though. He gives an alternative. Another way to explain our definition is to understand that kavya is a jati. What's a jati? Like an elephant is a species? It's a kind of animal that can mate among themselves?
It's a category.
Well, yeah, but a category in a technical sense, a very technical sense of what jati really is. It's a real category, not an imagined one. Cowness is a quality, a jati, that's possessed by all cows. Cowness, where is cowness anyway? Do they keep it in a safe deposit bank in the SBI, or is it somewhere in the dictionary? Where does it reside? In all the cows is where cowness is to be found. It's spread out throughout all the cows. And it's not there in the horses and elephants. It's in cows. And what is cowness? It's a special quality that cows have that other things don't have. And when you give a definition, what you're doing, what you can be doing, is indicating a jati. The special, jati, it tells you the special characteristic of something that makes it different than everything else. That's one way of defining things. Just simply say what's different about them. What's different? What differentiates it from everything else? That's a good way to define. And that's really defining in terms of jati. So here also, we are defining kavya as kavi van nirmiti. That's also a quality that resides in all poetry. That is written by a poet, and that it's a composition of words. It's created by a poet, and it's a composition of words. If the poet, makes a ladu, makes a rasgulla, then that's not poetry. He made a rasgulla, it's his creation, but it's not words. And it's not, the technical sense of nirmiti is words that create astonishment. But there's that quality that resides in all poetry of being such a thing, a verbal astonishment-evoking composition of a poet. And another way to explain that is that this kavyatva is something that can be recognized. You may ask, well, what is kavyatvam? Well, that you have to experience. What is cowness? Well, if you ever saw a cow, you would if you were a cowherd, you would know what cowness is. You'd be an expert on it. So the experts know what it is. The experts can recognize the jati when they see one. Cowness, you can say cowness is being a four-legged animal with a dewlap. But there's more to being a cow than just that. What's the use of a cow if it has four legs and a dewlap but doesn't give any milk? And, maybe you have other purposes for a cow. You need some fertilizer. So the cows also produce fertilizer. These are other qualities outside of the definition. But cowherds are interested in getting their cow patties and selling them and getting their milk and selling that. Otherwise, they wouldn't be keeping the cows. So the person who really knows the jati is not just the person who theoretically learns the definition, but the person who knows, has realization, who really deals with the thing. So who really knows what kavyatvam is? The connoisseurs, sarvideya. The connoisseurs of poetry know poetry. People who can relish properly poetry. Savridaya ridayaswadya kopi kavyatva lakshano. There's some special quality in poetry called kavyatvam. And what kavyatvam is really knowable. We can define it, we can give some definition of it. It's really known by those who are connoisseurs. They feel it in their hearts. When they hear poetry, they recognize it immediately. That's another way of looking at the definition. It's really something you have to experience. We can talk about it theoretically, but until you meet one of these four-legged animals with the dewlap, you don't really know what it is. Until you actually can relish poetry, you don't know poetry from, you know, somebody's laundry list. Until you can actually experience it. This is the problem with studying this shastra, is that you got to actually experience. You got to be able to sense things. It's not just mental. The ideas, it's not that the ideas are so, the definitions are so hard to understand, but it's hard to tell what's the difference between one and another. The definitions seem to be almost the same for many of these, like the alankars. There's 63 alankars. And the hard job is not understanding what they're saying, the definitions, but understanding what makes the difference between one of them and another one. They seem so similar, almost the same. So you have to be able to, you have to actually get into it and experience the poetry in order to develop a sense of discrimination. Okay. Continuing, the next snippet, the sort of piece of a kavaka, it's not a complete kavaka, is nipunam kavi karmatat. Something more about poetry. We defined it, but we want to say one more thing about it. That it's the expert activity of a poet. Okay, but what's a poet? You told us that you're going to give us a technical definition of a poet that will excuse you of the fault of arguing around in a circle, because you're going to define poet in such a way that it's not just dependent on being the person who writes the poem. What is a poet, beside being the person who writes poetry? What's special about him? So here's the definition. This is the swarupa, the essential identity of a poet. Sabijo hi kavirgeya sa sarv agama kovidaha sarasak prati bashali yadi syad uttamas tada. A poet should be understood as somebody who has the seed of poetry. Sabija, he's got the seed. The innate genius. And other qualities are listed. Expert in all agamas. Agamas doesn't mean just all tantras and pranjaratras. Here it means particular scriptures that are useful for a poet. Like a poet should know about weapons, he should know about botany and zoology. These things are, you know, he has to describe animals and plants and battles in his poetry, so he has to know the textbooks that describe these subjects, practical subjects, agamas, and all kinds of agamas. He should be expert in them. He should be a walking encyclopedia. Sarasa, and he should be able to relish rasa. Pratibhashali. He's got to have a quick wit. He's got to be able to come up with an idea to match any situation very quickly. Pratibha in logic, one of the faults by which you can lose a debate is apratibha. That means someone raises an objection to your argument, and there may be an answer, but you can't think of it. Problem isn't that there's no proper answer, but you can't think fast enough to come up with it. And you lose the argument for the fault of apratibha. You're not thinking fast enough. You can't come up with a quick answer. So that also a poet has to be able to quickly, you know, come up with the right ideas or the right ways of saying things. He can't be sitting there and spending, you know, 10 years on each word. Then he's not a very good poet. He's got to be quick. And yadisyat. If he has these qualities, then utamastada. Then he's a first-class poet. The Kavi Karnapur explains that actually there's only only the first qualification is the actual definition, sabija. He's got to have the seed of genius. The others are just further explanations of what are the characteristics of someone who has the seed of genius. So the necessary part of the definition is that he has the seed. If he has the seed, then he can also manifest these other qualities, especially if he's a first-class poet. If he's a bad poet, then maybe he doesn't show so much of these other qualities. But if he's a really good poet, then he also has these qualities. He knows all kinds of practical scriptures. He really knows what rasa is. He's very clever and can come up with ideas easily. Then he's an excellent poet. Okay, now subdivision, two kinds of poets, and this is coming from the Kavya Alankar sutras. It doesn't say here who wrote them. I forget. Kavya Alankar Sutra, we have a copy of it. Tells us about the two kinds of poets and gives them a special terms. One kind of poet is arochika, arochiki. And the other one is trina, satrina avyavahari. Literally that means someone who doesn't like. Someone who's not satisfied. Arochika. Discriminating. And the other one is someone who eats mixed with grass. The Arochika is the discriminating poet who's not satisfied with any kind of, mediocre poetry. A discriminating poet is not satisfied to write anything mediocre or to hear anything mediocre. Whereas the other kind of poet, it's like a cow that eats gray mixed up with grass. He'll take anything. He does not discriminating. And Kavi Karnabar says actually only the discriminating poet is a real poet. The other one is just not good enough. Yes, Prue. The word satrina abhyavahari. That means eating mixed with grass. Subdhamadhar is? Yeah, very discriminating. He won't accept anything mediocre. But that's a real poet. He's discriminating. Okay, now, what about... Yes, please. Well... We have to define, that's the next question. What is the bija? So the definition will be given. First, let's see what it is. And then first the lakshana. We just did the udesha. We mentioned bija. Now we have to define it. And then you're asking for the pariksha. How do we know it's there? First of all, let's do the lakshana of bija. Bija. Bijam praktana samskara vishesha kavya roha bu. The seed is a particular, let's say, karmic trace from previous life. Praktana samskara vishesha. Kavya roha, of course, we have all sorts of previous propensities from our previous lives, and some of them are not very good. They're not all the bija that we're talking about. Those are bijas of something else. But qualified kavya roha bu. It's a particular samskara from a previous life that is the ground on which kavya sprouts up, the ground from which kavya grows, like a fertile field for the growth of kavya. Yes, distinguish it from other kinds of bijas. Or let's say, I guess the bija, it's a bovri, the bija that's in the ground. The bija that sprouts in the ground of kavya. Now, this sprouting is of two kinds. Nirmatri mula and swadaka mulas. When the seed is rooted in, when you plant the seed in the composer of the poetry, that's one kind of sprouting. The poetry, the seed, has its effect on the through the author's creative abilities. But also there is the ability of the audience to appreciate the poetry. That bija also acts on the audience. It gets planted in the author, it also gets planted in the audience. Well, okay. It seems like that, but I think practically speaking, if you're just a member of the audience and you never wrote a poem and you never intend to, then you're not a poet. And yeah, well, what I'm confused here, the seed, whose seed is it? Is it the poet that's putting his own seed in the audience, or is it the audience's own seed? I sort of stopped preparing at about this point this morning, so I didn't read Vishwanath very clearly here. I had to check again. Yes. I mean, who has the seed? Does the audience also have that seed? And then you're asking, well, isn't an audience a poet? Poets also. But if they don't write poetry, they're not poets. So let me check that, whether the audience is supposed to be considered to have the seed also. Or it's just the poet with the genius he has, he awakens something in the audience, not that the audience has the genius. They do have an ability to appreciate rasa and a sympathy, a savidya. They're savidyas, they're connoisseurs. But is that supposed to mean that they have the same bija that the author does? Let me just check that and see what's intended. Yes?
This one of the five things is when an advanced devotee, he gets the uddipana when he sees things related to Krishna. So the rasa gets evoked in his heart by this uddipana. So that means that even if like a normal poetry is shown to him, he will appreciate it and the rasa will be evoked to him. So in that case, the bija is in him rather than in the poetry itself. Isn't it true?
You're talking about a case, and this won't always happen. If it was so, then why do we read only the Bhagavatam? Let's read all garbage, because anything we read will evoke our rasa. Only, it's unusual when mundane literature will evoke rasa. There are cases, it's called vyaja, where a devotee hears something mundane, but it awakens, it serves as an udipana. This famous verse that Lord Chaitanya spoke about, being on the bank of the Reva, and I'm the same girl, and he's the same boy, and it's supposed to be about Radha and Krishna. It's not. The Reva is not the Jamuna. It was written by a mundane poet, but Lord Chaitanya took it and recited it in front of Jagannath. He saw something spiritual in it. That's called vyaja. It's written by a mundane poetry. It wasn't intended spiritually, but it was the audience took it spiritually. But that's not the usual case. Mundane, otherwise we could waste our time reading mundane poetry. Instead of reading Bhagavatam, we can go get the newspapers and read that.
No, like this, there was one statement of Gopi Bihi Virahati, that Vijahati Krishna, there's one statement, and that has been refuted. But it can, that...
Well, it's not... Yes. So that's not poetry because it doesn't... It's just a... It was spoken by a person who's not expert. It just literally tries to describe rasa, but you can't not describe rasa just by the literal meaning of words. You can't awaken rasa just by saying the words. So therefore it's not real poetry because it doesn't really awaken anything in anybody.
But
a transcendental person could hear anything and it could serve as an Udipana, but it's not it doesn't normally awaken in the average audience, in the regular audience. If you're in Mahabhava, then anything can be an Udipana for you. But normally, something that's written by someone who doesn't know rasa is not going to awaken rasa in somebody else, normally. Yes, Jennifer. Yeah.
Krishna Chakravarti Thakur addresses the question which is...
Who's got the beach?
In the last sentence of the commentary on the fourth karaka, yeah?
Yeah.
Tena kavi bhinne kavya svadavati sahridaye asvadana hetu bhuta praktana sanskara vishesha vatva rupa lakshanasya na samanvaya iti bhavaha. So he speaks about the bija, which is svadaka mula, within the very poet who writes the poetry, like not within the people who are like kavibhinnas, who are,
yes.
It means both these bijas, both this which are nirmatri mulaha and svadaka mulas, are within the poet.
Yeah, it's like, the poet's bija.
That's what it says.
The poet's bija has its effect on the poet. And it has an effect on the audience too, but it's the poets.
It's poets.
The poets' bija. Genius.
Yeah.
Now, the audience have their own qualification. They, to be an audience of real poetry, you have to be rasika too, but it's a different qualification. You don't have to write poetry to appreciate poetry. You do have to have special qualification, but it's different. It is a kind of bija, but it's not the particular bija we're talking about here. Any kind of samskara is a kind of seed, but we're talking about a particular seed, the seed of being a poet. The genius of a poet. The audience has some sort of genius of their own, but that's the genius of an audience. That's different.
So in that sense, that a poet, a wholesome poet, he is not only, he should be also able to appreciate the poetry of others, otherwise, yes. If he doesn't have that mula, he'll be kind of a crippled,
yes,
kind of egoistic, proud, just writing without appreciating the other's creations, like that.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Certainly, a poet has to be experienced in poetry. Practically, if you want to become a good poet, best first preparation is to study a lot of poetry. Become familiar with poetry by knowing other people's poetry. You want to learn an art, you should study how previous artists did things. And then if you want to do something original, you can do that later. You should learn an art first by imitation, and then you can be original after you've assimilated what other people have done. Yes. You see, we can analyze, we can look at this discussion of the theory of poetry on different levels. We can get very analytic about it. We can be very logical about it. Even the Kavya Prakash by Mamata is quite popular. I have one edition with 16 different commentaries. And two of the commentaries are written by Navanyaya logicians. And they read into the Kavya Prakash all sorts of discussions of higher logic. It's all about logic as far as they're concerned. But, that's a little unusual. You can read almost anything. You can talk about grammar, you can talk about logic. But poetry is about poetry. The theory of poetry should be about poetry. Yes?
So about this bija, it is said that it's like some samskara from the previous life, but is it possible to acquire this bija? Because in this present
avoid
life,
the bija.
This poetic bija, yeah. Because it implies that in some previous life, somehow or another, he got this samskara, or otherwise, how he ever was able to get it.
I'm sorry? Oh. Well, prakrita means very old. Does it necessarily mean previous life? Prakrita samskara, yeah. Um, I think it's just saying that becoming a poet takes several lifetimes of experience. There's a, you know, in a particular lifetime, you finally graduate. You finish the pre-poetry course of life, experiencing life, and then in the current life, the seed actually is developed and you become a poet. But it's just, this meaning, I think the why saying practicum means that it takes more than one lifetime to develop all that, to develop the seed.
But at the same time, we know that if Bhakti Bhagavata Kinchinas Rivargunas Tatra Samasata Surah, that all good qualities, they've been developed in one who is engaged in a lot of devotional service. So it implies that devotee, he may also become a perfect
Okay, poet. Let's say there can be exceptions. We're guessing here. You know, this wasn't discussed in the commentary, what praktana means. We're just guessing what it means. But let's take the case of Dhruva Maharaj. 5-year-old, but we don't know what he did in his last life. It was asked this morning. But we, you know, we don't have the history in front of us, Dhruva's previous life. But he was just a boy, you know, only 5 years old, probably didn't study grammar yet or anything. And Vishnu touched him on the head with a conch shell, and he became a great poet. Also, this case of Kalidas. He was a fool. You know, and what happened? He was worshiping Kali, and she blessed... What is, the whole story that, you know, he married a princess, you know, Vararuchi, who was, you know, was very brilliant, but he wasn't very attractive, and he made a scheme by which the girl ended up marrying Kalidas, even though he was a fool. Vararuchi made the princess and the king think that he wasn't a fool. And then his wife wasn't satisfied with him, that he really was a fool. And then how did he get, went and worshipped Kali? His wife sort of kicked him out of the house and he went to worship Kali. And then Kali blessed him and overnight he turned into a great poet. Happened overnight. But we don't know Kalidas's previous life either. Yeah?
So, excuse me. Yeah, okay. So I just want to trace the stages of development of these poetic skills. So first must be a stage in which one can appreciate poetry written by others. Then he starts to thinking, maybe I'll try to write down myself, and first his composition might be not so perfect, and then he tries, and may take a few lifetimes, and in one particular lifetime, he happens to be a good poet.
Well, that makes sense. I didn't hear it from anybody before you said it, but it makes sense. Yeah, okay, that you have to, first of all, be a connoisseur before you can expect to become a poet, and you can expect it to take many lifetimes. Yeah.
It's like many other arts, like music. Some people have got it and some people don't.
Yes.
Some people, they just don't have enough, I don't know, they don't have enough Venus in their chart or something. You know, to play something. And so I've had experience even teaching some people, for example, mridanga. You know, some people just, you don't even have to teach them, they just pick it all up and they're naturals. And other people, even if you got like very, break it down for them and record it for them and write it down for them, and they just still can't get it, you know, because they don't have it.
Don't have the seed.
They don't have the seed.
And it's apparently something that goes back into previous lives. It's not something I did in this life that I picked up the seed somewhere. It was developing for more than one lifetime. Yes.
As you told in the beginning, he's trying to avoid bringing in like actual Krishna conscious topics and definitions, like examples he might give. So is that the reason why he gives the definition of a poet as having these kind of skills, rather than saying, I mean, a poet is one who can really get the mercy of Lord, and I mean,
I don't think he's trying to avoid devotional discussions. He's just trying to stay to the topic at hand. It's not that Jiva Goswami is avoiding devotional service because he's talking about verbs and adjectives. No, because the topic is grammar, therefore you have to talk about grammar, not just about the Rasa Lila. So also, here we have, yes, yeah, so you can say a poet is someone who has spiritual, you know, has gotten the blessings of his guru and has love of God. But you have many devotees who aren't poets. And you have other devotees who don't even like poetry, who don't, you know, would rather read philosophy. You know, or devotees who are illiterate, don't read anything. You know, could hardly understand their own language. They're just sort of simple people. They're still devotees, even though they're not poets or even connoisseurs. So it's not, we can't define a poet as a devotee, because then all the devotees should be poets, and they're not. Devotees, you know, the poets are a very small subcategory of devotees. So we have to give them a special definition.
Every devotee cannot be a poet, but every poet has to be a devotee.
Yes, we'll agree with that. At least the way that our author is defining poetry and poet, yes. But it's like, we're already assuming, like, this was written after Bhaktivedanta Sindhu. So he's not going to bother to explain everything that Rupa Goswami explained in the Bhaktivedanta Sindhu about what rasa is. There is a chapter on rasa, but he says, of course, there's bhakti rasa and kavya rasa. Bhakti rasa we already know about, you know, from Bhaktivedanta Sindhu. I'm going to tell about its special application as kavya rasa. So the reason why he's not talking about the basic qualifications of a devotee, because that's explained elsewhere already. But he's adding on, what's special among all the devotees, what's special about the few of them that are poets?
But the other, like the material poets and students of poetry, they may not would have read the Bhaktivedanta Sindhu before. No?
And then they might pick up this book.
Yeah, so they would
and then they'll read it and say, hey, this is a nice book about poetry. And they won't see that it's really written, you know, that it's actually Vaishnava propaganda. It's all describing in poetic terms, so things that are familiar. And they'll become interested in it, and they'll read all the verses about Radha Krishna, and they'll become converted, maybe. If it was done in too fanatic a way, that, you know, poetry is only for Vaishnavas, the rest of you can go to hell. If he said that in the beginning, then he would scare away everybody else. That goes without saying. You know, that he makes it clear what real rasa is, and that mundane rasa is tasteless. Near rasa is really, mundane poetry is near rasa, has no real rasa. That he says. He doesn't say it in the very beginning, though. He says it when he gets to the chapter on rasa. Yes.
Is there some non-technical definition of kavi? Because we see it's one of the 26 qualities of a devotee. He's supposed to be a kavi.
All the devotees should be kavis. Do all devotees have to have that quality? Right, but do all devotees have to have all 26 qualities? Well, of course, kavi also means a scholar. Shukracharya is called kavi. Brahma is called Adi Kavi. Not because he wrote poetry, because he's the first learned person. So kavi also just means learned person. Kavi nam ushana kavi. Among kavis, I'm ushana, who's not known as a poet. So there are other meanings of the word kavi. You can say that relative to ordinary, to other people, a devotee is poetical. He may not be a professional poet, but he's more poetic than non-devotees, automatically by being a devotee. Even though he may have no professional skills. We shouldn't be naive and think that we're Shakespeare just because we're devotees. You want to really become a poet, you have to have this, you know, have the real talent, and you have to get the real training. You want to write professional poetry. Okay. So we'll stop here. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Shri Kavi Karnapur Ki Jai.